You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Anchor is a Spotify-owned company that makes it easy for people to get into podcasting. It's an all-in-one, totally free platform where you can record a podcast, host it, distribute it, measure your performance analytics, and find sponsors. It all works through your web browser or through Anchor's mobile app. Give Anchor a try for free at anchor.fm/kickassnews. That's anchor.fm/kickassnews. And now, on with the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. My guest today is Joyanne Reed, the host of the twice-weekly show AM Joy on MSNBC. Joy's been called a heroine of the resistance by the New York Times, and she's written what she calls a survival guide for the Trump era, offering advice and insight for dealing with the daily outrages of the Trump administration and an uplifting, action-oriented roadmap to preserve and protect America's future as a beacon of democracy. The book is called The Man Who Sold America, Trump and the Unraveling of the American Story, and today Joy Reed joins me on the show to talk about it. She says if you truly want to understand Donald Trump, you have to have been around New York City in the 70s and 80s, an era that this DC Comics fan likens to the lawlessness of Batman's Gotham City, and if New York in the 80s was Gotham, she says Donald Trump was surely its Joker. Then Joy tells the story of her parents' immigration from Guyana and the Democratic Republic of the Congo and suggests that America could learn something about healing division from post-apartheid South Africa. Looking ahead to 2020, Joy believes that unregistered voters are a potential goldmine for Democrats just waiting to be tapped. She sees inroads that the Democratic nominee could make with white working-class males, but she also explains that the hungriest constituency wins elections, and this time, the hungriest constituency will be women. Plus, she weighs in on the first Democratic debate, shares the nickname that her daughter gave Beto O'Rourke, and predicts that 2020 will be the election that makes 2016 look sane by comparison. Coming up with Joyanne Reed in just a moment. Joyanne Reed is the host of AM Joy, a twice-weekly political talk show that airs weekends on MSNBC. Joy also serves as a political analyst, appearing on NBC News and MSNBC programs including Meet the Press, Hardball with Chris Matthews, The Rachel Maddow Show, and The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell. Joy has written columns for The New York Times, The Miami Herald, The Sun Sentinel, Salon.com, and The South Florida Times. She's the author of two books, including Fracture, Barack Obama, the Clintons, and the Racial Divide, and now she follows it up with her latest offering, titled The Man Who Sold America, Trump and the Unraveling of the American Story. Joy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, I enjoyed your book. It offers a very detailed account of the Trump era, and it's good to be reminded of just how many of the norms of the presidency have been shattered by this man. But in the intro, you say that to truly understand Donald Trump, you have to have been around New York City in the 70s and 80s. You're someone who has lived in New York on and off for much of your life. Enlighten me. What does that tell us about this man?
Well, basically, New York in the 70s and 80s, and I didn't live in New York until I was born in Brooklyn, New York, but then we moved when I was 2 years old. I moved back to New York in 1987 after my mother passed away, and I moved back to East Flatbush, which where my aunt lived. And New York at that time was very different than it is now. I mean, Brooklyn was still Brooklyn. It wasn't gentrified. Harlem was still Harlem. It wasn't gentrified. But there was also incredible racial polarization in New York. I wasn't used to it coming from Denver, Colorado, a little suburb that was a mostly black suburb that was, you know, we had working class and middle class black and some white people. It was a mostly black suburb. So when I moved to New York, it was culture shock. There were neighborhoods in Queens and Brooklyn that were Italian or Jewish, where as a black person, if you walked into that neighborhood, you would get chased out, probably with baseball bats.
Really?
There was Howard Beach and Bensonhurst were like notorious for black people because we knew that people like Yusuf Hawkins had been chased to his death there. There was the Bernard Goetz situation in 88 where a white German man shot at or attacked four black kids basically on the train who he claimed were trying to rob him. There was all of this violence, and it was almost all racialized violence. The police were even more threatening than police are, you know, now for African Americans. There was a sense that the NYPD was out to get you if you were black. There was a Central Park Five case who were some kids a little younger than me who were 14 and 15 years old who were getting accused of rape and thrown in prison for more than a dozen years in one case. So it was a different New York. And that was Donald Trump's New York. Donald Trump is an ethnic white guy from Queens who is a lot like a lot of other ethnic white guys from Queens, who it's an Italian neighborhood, so only Italians should live here, or it's an Irish neighborhood. This is an Irish neighborhood only. Why are these black people trying to move in? A lot of that integration, anxiety, and tension, and even violence, it wasn't just in the South. It was in the North, in the Northeast, in these white ethnic neighborhoods where black people moving in were met with real hostility. And Donald Trump was a landlord, and he was a landlord who wouldn't rent to people like me.
And speaking of the Central Park Five, I mean, I think a lot of people forget that Donald Trump was the one who took out a full page ad in, I forget, the New York Times and New York Post calling for the execution of the Central Park Five before they'd even been tried.
Yeah, and he did. And I think it was both. He took out ads in multiple papers. So I didn't know who Donald Trump was really until the Central Park Five. He was well known in the tabloid press as this sort of real estate mogul Lothario character. But I did not come to know that until many years later when he was on The Apprentice. When I got to New York, Donald Trump was this really rich guy who said a lot of, you know, pretty nasty things about the Japanese and the Chinese and constantly complained about them. But I mainly knew Donald Trump as the guy who took out ads to kill the Central Park Five. So from my perspective as a young black person who hadn't grown up in New York and was coming to this really balkanized tribal version of New York where there was a lot of lot more poverty that was visible and where the neighborhood lines were invisible but real. You knew that Crown Heights was black on one side and Jewish on one side, and God help you if you crossed the line, like where there were riots, a literal racial riot in 1991, where going in a store, you knew that there was a Korean-American grocer who had been violent toward a black person who they'd, you know, accused of stealing, and where you'd be accused of stealing just for walking into stores. It was a different place. And Donald Trump was kind of the king of New York at that time. He was the guy who was kind of the circus conductor. He was a over-the-top figure, but those who studied what he and his family were actually doing, they were amassing property. The dad was, right? Starrett City, some of these huge properties. And then what they were doing is they were saying only white people can live here. They would rent to Jewish people, but they wouldn't. And one of the reasons they changed their name from Drumpf, which is German, to Trump was allegedly, according to a couple biographers, because they didn't think a German name would be conducive to renting to Jewish tenants. So they end up changing their name because of
That's
business.
That's interesting. I've never heard that before.
Yeah. I recount that story that was reported by a couple of his biographers in the book. So they were all about business. And the father was notoriously a very mean man, a very hard man. He's known in New York as somebody who destroyed Coney Island. Who bought up a lot of the real estate and then shut down the Ferris wheel and all the beautiful attractions because he just wanted more money, basically.
Yeah.
So the Trumps were not known as nice people.
You compare that era in New York to Batman's Gotham,
which,
with the crime and everything, and that makes for a pretty apt comparison. And you say if it's Batman's Gotham, then Trump was surely the Joker.
Yeah, and
it's funny. Just because he's a clown or what?
No, because of the Joker, I grew up on comics, and Marvel has the great movies now, but when I was growing up, I was more of a DC Comics person.
Sure.
I love Batman and Superman. I'm happy Aquaman is cool now because Aquaman at the time was kind of lame. But now Aquaman, at least in the movie that I just watched on the plane coming over here, he was pretty cool now. But Batman is sort of he's the ultimate human superhero, right? He's not Superman. He's not from another planet. He's just a really rich, bored guy who's angry because his parents are killed and he decides to become a vigilante. His opposite in most of the character iterations of the Joker is also a really rich guy who's also bored and who decides that his mission in life is to destroy Batman.
Yeah.
So anything Batman does, he does the opposite. If Batman is trying to make the city clean, he wants to make it dirty.
Mm-hmm.
If Batman wants to make the city safe, he wants to make it unsafe. And his job in his mind is just to sow chaos.
Yeah.
And because he's rich, there's no impediment. He doesn't have a job. All he does is sow chaos. And to me, Donald Trump reminds me of that, both because the New York he was in was more Gotham-like. There was more overt poverty and drug addiction and the crack epidemic, more violence, more police violence, and more person-on-person civilian violence, but also more ostentatious, really extravagant wealth. This was the era when wealth was really celebrated. It was the dynasty in Dallas era, lifestyles of the rich and famous. So there was that juxtaposition. And Donald Trump was in that wealthy category that we knew of at the time. We didn't know he was broke. And he used his wealth to sow chaos. He would go on TV and talk about how America was going to the dogs. This will sound familiar. How Japan is eating our lunch. China is eating our lunch. No one respects us anymore. He used to say the same exact things. And he always had a foreign villain. The villain was always some non-white country that was destroying us from within. And black people were an inconvenience that he, at least according to the settlement with the started by the Nixon administration, but ultimately settled in the Ford administration, they would put C for colored on the applications when a black family would try to rent in their buildings so that they wouldn't overtly say, we're not going to rent to you, but they would mark those applications C for colored and throw them in the bin.
Yeah, and I mean, it's hard to imagine that this man became the poster boy for disaffected white males in the Rust Belt who are struggling. I mean, here you have this slick New Yorker who was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, is supposedly the one person to champion their cause. I keep coming back to this since the election. What is it? Is it that those white working class males were just gullible, or was it that Trump was just that good a salesman?
Well, you know, one of the people that I interviewed for the book was Sam Nunberg. Sam met Donald Trump back in the mid-2000s. His father had a law firm or worked for a law firm that the Trumps were a client of. And so he wound up meeting Trump, ironically enough, through WWE, because of course, right? It's Donald Trump. And he describes Trump as very similar to like a retired cop or fireman. That their sensibility is they're sort of their white ethnic person who, you know, lives in their middle class neighborhood, maybe takes the boat out every weekend, who thinks, you know, the blacks are all criminals.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't they get their neighborhood together? Why do women have to be so mouthy? Sort of an Archie Bunker type,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Why is it that, you know, China is taking advantage of us? We should be on top. We're America. That sensibility Trump has is actually very similar to his base. So even though he is rich, his attitude is not like most affluent people. And in fact, the really affluent people in New York despise Trump. They look down on him as new money.
Right.
And it was his dad that made the money, not him. So Trump himself was not seen as this self-made marvel. He was just a guy who inherited a lot of money. And his father was never in a Manhattan rich guy. He was a Queens rich guy. So he amassed a lot of property and a lot of wealth, but he kept it in Queens. So what Donald Trump wanted to do was break out of Queens and get into Manhattan. And he really craved the respect of that elite. He wanted Anna Wintour to respect him. He wanted to be written up on the front page of the New York Times. He wanted to be in Time magazine. He wanted to be an A-lister, but he was really a B-lister, and it really sort of enraged him. And I think that anger at the elites in Manhattan, he also shares with his base. Mm-hmm. They also feel the New York Times doesn't respect us. Those Manhattanites don't respect us. The elite in Hollywood don't respect us. Trump feels
the same
way. They
have the same grievances.
They crave the adoration, respect, and the attention of the elites. They despise the elites that when they don't get it, including the culture, Hollywood, music, it's all liberal. And so I think he shares their sensibilities, even if he doesn't share their pocketbook situation.
And you provide another possible explanation that I hadn't heard before. You report that a number of Trump voters have said that they relate to him because he had so many failures. Do they see him as some type of avatar for themselves in that sense?
So Whitney Dow, who I interviewed for the book as well, his field of study really has become white America. Mm-hmm. And Whitney has something called the Whiteness Project, where he goes around the country just interviewing white people about their lives. Huh. And he elicits from them things that I could never get from them, because once they're comfortable with him, and he's very pointed about not even having a black cameraman. So when he's in there and interviewing these white Americans, they'll really open up to him after a while and tell him what they really think. And the Whiteness Project is fascinating. So Whitney goes to Wyoming and he interviews these white Americans and he talks to them about their anxieties and about Trump. And these are hardworking people. You know, they work on the land. They don't seem like they would be Trump kinds of people. They're religious. And with one of the women who he talks to, and I related in the books, she says, no, I relate to Trump because even though, you know, when he tells her, well, he was bankrupt like five times, he's not a successful businessman at all. She says, you know, but I've had failures. I relate to that. And I think that people relate to Trump not just because of the failures, but because he's bringing white Americans something much more important than real economic advancement. Mm-hmm. He plays into a tribalism that is real in the country and that has always existed. We've had racial tribalism since the country was founded, right? The only way to get slavery to work is you have to get the white tribe to hate the black tribe enough to enslave them and to agree with other people enslaving them and to agree to go to war to protect that system and to send your sons to die to protect the system you don't even benefit from for most white people. Racial tribalism never went away. But what happened is black people and brown people and Asian Americans developed a pride of place in the country and began to demand equal share of the power to live where they wanted to live, to do what they wanted to do, to work where they wanted to work. And white Americans, particularly ethnic white Americans for the Democratic Party, for whom the Democratic Party had been their champion, they see the gaze turning to those other ethnic groups. And they say, well, you've left us behind because now your concern is brown immigrants and black immigrants and African immigrants and Honduran immigrants. What about us? Mm-hmm. So when you say left behind, it's not economically. It's really more in terms of the racial attention, in terms of, you know, the racial tribe, which tribe is getting the attention. Donald Trump said, I'll pay attention to you. I'll only work for the white tribe. How about this? I'll deport the brown tribe. I'll get them all out of here. I'll ban the Muslim tribe. I'll make sure that the white tribe wins. Mm-hmm. And I read half a dozen studies in order to find out if Donald Trump's victory had to do with that, with racial tribalism, or with economic anxiety. All of the studies agreed. There is no data that shows that Donald Trump won because of racial anxiety. It's all ethnic tribalism and anger at the elites not paying attention to white Americans.
Do you think that this demographic panic that's going on is purely racist, or is there a way of making sense of what's going on with these voters? Because I guess if you can't rationalize it or somehow make sense of it, you're never going to be able to win those voters back. The Democrats are just going to lose that entire generation.
Yeah, you know, there's one person I quote in the book that is interesting that talks about, who's run a research study that's gone beyond the United States. Because the same thing, by the way, is happening in Europe.
Sure.
Vladimir Putin just this week at the G20 summit said that liberalism, big term liberalism, not American liberalism politically, but liberalism as a
liberal
concept.
Liberal democracy
is dead. He actually declared it DOA, and he said it's dying because multiculturalism is not going to work. People won't accept it. They're not going to accept immigration, and that everything about the liberal elite is wrong. People will reject it. one of the reasons that that Russia and Putin are so popular with white nationalists is he's seen as the champion of white Christians in Europe. And all across Europe, immigration is roiling and rankling those societies and producing versions of Donald Trump in their electorates as well. And so there's one guy that I quote in the book who's done a study that's encompassed the U.S. and Europe and said, the thing the Labor Party in the U.S., the more liberal party in France, the Socialist Party in France, the Angela Merkel's party in Germany, and the Democratic Party in the United States, what they have in common is in the 20th century after World War II, all of those more liberal parties focused on economic uplift. That was the thing that they were good at, right? The more conservative party was focusing on the elites and making sure that the rich had what they needed. But those more liberal parties were really, really fixated on economic uplift. But then they were successful. And particularly in the United States, after World War II, there was an economic boom like nothing the world had ever seen. And so when economic uplift became less urgent, those more liberal parties turned their attention to other things, to social uplift, to social equality, to women's equality, to gender equality, not just gender equality, but LGBT equality, you know, things like gay marriage. They turned their attention to things like immigration, non-white immigration, helping refugees. They started to turn their concerns toward culture and away from economic uplift. The voters who had counted on those being the parties of the working man, the working white Christian man, see this turn and see it as abandonment. Because they still want a party that focuses on their particular economic uplift. And that works when all the unions are mostly white and you can keep black people out of them, when the New Deal mostly helps white people. That's you getting. And now with all these other concepts, why are we talking about transgender people in bathrooms? That's not about me. And so a lot of white working class people, not just in America, but around the world, are turning away from these more liberal parties and burrowing themselves into the more conservative parties alongside the elite.
So then the question for Democrats in 2020 is, would it be better to focus on winning back those white male voters or focusing on minority turnout and new voter registration?
I think that this, all of the data that I've read anyway, and Robbie Jones is one of the people I quote in the book, who's an incredible demographer at the Public Religion Research Institute. He may be the best pollster in the country with all respect to all the others like Peter Hart and the Pew Research Center. And what he's shown, he wrote a book called The End of White Christian America, in which he quantified this in a book, is that once voters turn toward the conservative party, mostly in the United States, when white Christian voters turn that way, they don't really come back because their concerns really aren't actually economic anymore. It's the concept of the party focusing on other people. And so for white Christians in the United States who are now a minority, their minority status is what scares them. So there's nothing you can offer them economically. Free college won't bring them back. Offering them stuff won't bring them back. Saying, we'll get you better jobs or we'll get you Green New Deal jobs. That's not what they want. They want status. And so since the Democratic Party can't reconfer status on them, there's no way to get them back. Numerically, more liberal whites, black people, brown people, and Asian Americans are actually the majority already. It's just they don't vote as much. Right. And so for the Democratic Party, if you had $100 to spend, the best use of your $100 would be to register lots and lots and lots of unregistered voters, and they would vote Democratic because they still want stuff. And by the way, even among white voters, Donald Trump's voters are the most affluent of the Republican voters, not the poorest.
Really? That's interesting because that goes kind of counter to what I've heard over the past couple of years.
Well, part of what the media did is they sort of created this forgotten man, you know, story about the Trump voter that they were hard scrabbling down on their luck. But of the 17 people who ran for president on the Republican side, Donald Trump's voters were the most affluent. They had the most money.
Interesting.
Yeah. And Ted Cruz's were significantly poorer.
Huh.
And so were Marco Rubio's. And the reason for that is that people who are working class, quote unquote, who don't have people without a college degree, they're not necessarily poor. Like, we have come to think of people without a college degree as poor, but police officers often don't have a college degree. Firemen don't often have a college degree. Plumbers can become a plumber without a college degree. You can be a landscaper. You can own a business. There are all sorts of things you can do where you've got plenty of money. You just don't have a college degree. So we throw you in with the working class. Poor white people don't vote. They're one of the lowest turnout cohorts in the United States. If you're poor and white, you probably don't vote at all. But if you did vote, polling shows you would vote for Democrats because you still need economic uplift. And Democrats are still the party of economic uplift.
Interesting. So for Democrats, it's not just about registering minorities that aren't voting, but also the poor white voters in 100%. The Midwest and so forth.
And in the South. Huh. The Democrats have essentially abandoned the South because they see it right. now as right-wing Republican territory, which mostly it is.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, Barack Obama won, 45% of the vote in South Carolina?
Yeah.
Okay, he got 10 and 11% in Mississippi and Alabama. Those are tougher states. But those states have a higher percentage of black voters than Michigan. And Democrats can win Michigan. Democrats walked away from the South and I think abandoned a lot of voters, particularly rural, white, poor voters, who, if they voted, would vote for Democrats. But they are poor, so they don't vote. Poor people of all races don't really vote. But they need the most, and they need the most from the government. So Democrats would actually probably spend their money better going into the Mississippi Delta and registering poor black voters, going into the mountains of West Virginia, registering poor white voters. If Democrats actually paid attention to the poor, most of those people they would find would support them.
And I've heard you say that it's not necessarily the biggest constituency, but the hungriest constituency that gets their way usually in a presidential election. Who do you think is going to be hungriest in 2020?
Well, I can tell you that in 2016, it was anti-immigration voters. Anti-immigration voters were rabid because part of what happened with Barack Obama was that during his election in 2008 was the second time the census made a big splash about white Americans becoming the minority in America, and they rolled back the date. When this was first announced in 1998, when Bill Clinton was president, it was 2052. In 2008, the summer of 2008, when they said it again and made a big deal of it while the black guy's running for president, who people were calling a Muslim, it was 2008 in the summer, and they rolled it back to 2047 or 2042. So the date keeps getting closer. That set off a panic among a lot of white Americans who don't want to be in the minority and white Christians who already are in the minority. So they were a very hungry constituency. And then there was a lot of antipathy to Hillary Clinton. I think Democrats underestimated how much rage and hatred against her had been built up over than 40 years. And they just took for granted that she could win every voter Obama won, which obviously was not true. I think because Hillary Clinton was, quote unquote, supposed to win, because all the data said she was going to win, and because Donald Trump was taken as the joker, as a clown, people underestimated the power of white ethno-nationalism to put a president in office. Women were shocked by it. And a lot of women weren't that excited about a woman president. They didn't think it was necessarily necessary. When I was going around for MSNBC interviewing people during the primary, I would find particularly young white women just didn't care about having a woman president.
Really? There wasn't the excitement that one would expect?
No. I talked to a group when I was in Iowa, for instance, and I pulled together a whole little focus group of first-time voters. And it was six white guys and six white girls. They were between the ages of 18 and 24-ish. They were young. They were college students. And of that group, the three guys had more interest in having a woman president than the three girls.
Huh.
And the three young white women, they were sort of middling about it. They didn't really care. They didn't really have a great deal of affection for Hillary Clinton. I think one of them was for Bernie. They weren't really enthusiastic. And that was her problem, right? Hillary Clinton needed a little more enthusiasm right. to get over the hump. But when she lost, and it shocked everybody, no one was more shocked than women.
Mm-hmm.
No one was more dispirited than women. No one felt more threatened. Well, lots of people felt threatened, immigrants, black people,
sure.
Muslims, brown people. But women, I think, also felt a responsibility, particularly white women who mostly voted for Trump, 52% voted for Trump. At the time that Donald Trump won, I was teaching a class at Syracuse University, and my class was race, gender, and media. Most of the students were white. Most of the students were women. And the very first class I had was the week after the Women's March, so the Wednesday after the Women's March. And so we just had an open conversation about the Women's March and about the election. And almost to a woman, the white young women in my class were really shaken by Trump winning because they didn't expect it. And the enthusiasm they didn't have for Hillary Clinton, I suspect they would have if they got the chance again. So I think despite what the polls show, it's highly likely that the last two people standing will be women, Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris.
Okay.
I think there's a good chance that they get to the finish line. Mm-hmm. Biden is strong now, but I think women want it the most.
Yeah. But does it always boil down to just voting for a candidate who looks like your constituency? Or is it possible that women voters might still turn out in record numbers regardless of whether they have a Kamala Harris or an Elizabeth Warren at the top of the ticket?
It's possible. It depends, right? It depends on the age. It depends on the region, and it depends on the woman.
Okay.
There's a lot of data that shows that married women, particularly married white women, tend to vote however their husbands vote. And there's very little divergence between the votes of women and their husbands.
Really? In this day and age?
In this day and age, still. Married white women are the most Republican women, particularly married white Christian women. They vote almost entirely as their husbands vote. Single white women don't vote. They're one of the lower turnout constituencies, and they're in the most jeopardy in a lot of ways in terms of reproductive rights.
Mm-hmm.
But they are very low voter turnout. African-American women are the highest voter turnout of any constituency. They vote consistently, particularly if they're over 40. They just almost always vote. So you have all these variations in women and who turns out. Hispanic women, Latina women are much lower turnout. Asian-American women have typically been lower but getting higher. They're a smaller group, but they are getting bigger in terms of size. So it depends on the woman. So who could be the Democratic nominee? It doesn't have to be a woman, but it has to be somebody who can somehow meet the needs and desires of women, Black people, Hispanic people, Asian-Americans, gay people, trans people, everybody else that isn't white male.
Yeah.
And so, or white women,
it's a big
or who
tent,
isn't white.
Or it needs to be a big tent.
It's a huge tent, and it's hard to move a big tent.
Yeah.
So, Democrats have both an advantage and a disadvantage because there's just a lot more people to serve. Joe Biden's finding that out now.
Now, you say that Democrats often focus on the economic message and ignore race. Do you think that the Democratic nominee can get away with that this year, or is it impossible to ignore race?
It's going to be hard. Democrats who've been successful at winning the presidency, like Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama, have de-emphasized race as a way to keep as many white voters as they can.
Mm-hmm.
Democrats have not won the majority of white voters since Lyndon Johnson. The highest percentage of white voters that Democrats have gotten are Barack Obama, who got 42% when he won in 2008, and Jimmy Carter, who got about 46%.
Mm-hmm.
So Carter was the high watermark, and then it just kept going down from there. And so in order to win the election, there's a formula that the Obama people used to call, they used to call it the 80-28 rule, right? That 28%, when 28% of the overall electorate is minority, you need 80% of that 28 in order to win. And you need to hold about 35 to 40% of white voters, 35%-ish of white men, and about 48% of white women, 49. Hillary Clinton actually got the highest percentage of white women since probably in 40 years, but she only got 48%. She maxed out. Democrats, in order to beat Trump, which will be hard because he's an incumbent, if they could get that 48% of white women to 50, they could beat him.
And I think to the extent that the Democrats need to talk about race again, Kamala Harris did a pretty good job the other night at the debate, putting race back on the front burner and talking about it in a very personal and meaningful way that resonated with voters. What did you think about the first debate?
It was very Obama-like, right? Like she used a personal anecdote and a personal story to personalize the issue for people. I thought the debates were interesting in that going into it, the story was, will Joe Biden emerge as unbeatable? Will Bernie Sanders go after Joe Biden? Who, the battle of the bees, Biden, Buttigieg, Bernie, and Beto, right? But in the end, none of those guys emerged as the winner.
Yeah.
The people who stood out were the people of color and the women. In the first debate, it was Julian Castro who really owned the debate by going pretty hard against Beto and really shaking Beto O'Rourke.
Yeah.
And Cory Booker, who used his moments and is very he's got the gift of gab. So anytime you get a chance, he gets a chance to talk, he's going to do well. And Elizabeth Warren, who kind of won by not losing. She didn't get attacked. Nobody went for her, even though she was the front runner in that on that stage. She was in the center position. She managed to get through all of her points with nobody really checking her.
Mm-hmm.
So she won the first debate. The second debate was all Kamala Harris, just all Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting about the Democratic Party now is that generationally, even older Black voters all want Biden. Older voters are saying, we got to go with Biden. We got to be safe. We can't talk about race. We can't do identity politics. We need to stick with an economic message that's directed at the white working class. Go with Biden. Younger voters are not going for that. So it's going to be a challenge.
Yeah.
Only one of those two sides can win.
Were there any huge surprises for you?
I thought Julian was a surprise.
Oh, yeah.
Castro,
he
right? He's very quiet. But I never saw in him what we got at that debate. He really went after Beto And he showed some political fire that I think was good for him and was surprising.
Yeah, I think someone said that Beto O'Rourke came off like the embarrassing dad at a Mexican restaurant.
Yeah, I probably should stop saying it. My daughter calls him Youth Pastor Beto. He reminds her of the youth pastors at the church we used to go to in Florida who like skateboard in to talk about Jesus.
Yeah, that's funny. You know, I want to ask you about your family background because you have an interesting history. Your mom came from British Guyana.
They freed themselves from the British. They dropped the British.
Oh, yeah. They probably wouldn't want to bring that up.
No.
Yeah. And your dad came from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. As President Trump would call them, I guess, shithole countries.
Yeah, pretty much.
As the daughter of immigrants, do some of these egregious policies from the Muslim ban to the family separations hit you particularly acutely?
Oh, absolutely. I think if Donald Trump and Stephen Miller, who's his sort of henchman inside the government that's implementing the policies, if they put in place the things that they want to, I would definitely not have been born here because both my parents would have been barred from coming here.
Yeah.
So it is personal. And you know, when they talk about chain migration, which, by the way, is how Melania Trump got her parents in. But anywho, that's how my mother got her family in, too. All my cousins wouldn't be here. We have a huge family that came from Guyana that's here. And so it is shocking. And my father, both my parents are deceased, but my father's best friend is still alive. I actually just saw him last week. And he and my dad came over in the 60s with that Kennedy program that Obama's family came over on. And the whole point of doing that was that when countries in Africa got their independence from the European overseers, their colonizers, there was a scramble between the USSR and the U.S., between the Soviet Union and the United States, to capture the kind of technocratic elite of those countries.
Yeah.
So that the next rulers of those countries, once they were democratic, small d democratic, would be pro-America or pro-Russia. So both countries actually offered to bring the best and brightest students either to Moscow or to the United States. The United States generally won. And the reason the United States was able to bring more people over and more people accepted my father, Barack Obama's father, they wanted to come here is because of the notion of what America is. It's a powerful notion. I mean, the United States emerged from World War II as the leader of the free world, the last Western man standing. Europe was in rubble. We had to rebuild it. The war took place on European soil, so they were broken as countries. Germany, the big power, was broken. Japan was broken. And the United States was the leader. And the United States held together the global order from then on, right up until Donald Trump became president. And one of the ways they did it was rhetorically. And you can go back to World War I, go back to Woodrow Wilson, a venally racist, horrible human being. Everything about him was vile and awful if you're black. But even he would sing the songbook. He had a story about what America was that was heroic. He had a narrative about America that was heroic. He never spoke about the Klan. He may have screened the Klan movie in the White House, but he wasn't out there saying, I'm going to come out here and create an America for white people. I'm going to make white America great again. He didn't say that. And he didn't tout that, right? He still tried to represent America as a convening force in the world and a force for good in the world. And a force for internationalism in the world, which is why there's Woodrow Wilson centers everywhere. So every president, even Nixon believed in the America that we read about. He believed still in the system. When the Supreme Court said you have to turn over the tapes, darn it, he turned over the tapes. He didn't want to, but he believed in the system. So Donald Trump is the first president who doesn't even say those words. He doesn't talk about America the same way, right? I mean, President Obama, all of them do. And so when you have a president who doesn't even pretend that we are trying to lead the world or that we're trying to be a force for good or sing the song of democracy, if those programs were to start in Africa now, I'm not sure they would come here.
And
that's a challenge. It's harder for us to attract the best and brightest from all around the world, which is what makes us such a great country. And people are afraid to come here.
Do you feel like he's erasing the American narrative?
Yeah.
And if so, what is he replacing it with?
Well, I interviewed a lot of people from around the world who, what they said is that their disappointment in not Trump, but us, is that when even Barack Obama, who I interviewed people from Africa, white and black, who love and respect Barack Obama on the level almost of Mandela, right? They think of him as this great man. But even when he would say, America is not here to take your oil, we're not here to rule over you, we want to encourage democracy here, they somewhat didn't believe it. They thought they rolled their eyes a little because they said, here goes America again. They're used to the songbook, right? It's such a well-known songbook that everybody knows it. So when each successive president sings it, you're like, okay, America, you're the leader of the free world. We get it. But part of them thought, you know, deep down, you really do want our oil. You know, when George W. Bush invaded Iraq, they said, mm-hmm, see? And then, but George W. Bush, to his credit, said, we're not here for your oil. Mm-hmm. No matter what Halliburton was actually doing, and no matter what profit they were actually making, George W. Bush rhetorically said, no, we're not here for your oil. Right. We're here for freedom.
Unlike Trump, who specifically said, we want your oil.
Yeah. Right. So when Trump comes out and says, no, we just want the oil, a lot of people go, see, we always knew that it was BS.
Interesting.
So they were in a way relieved that Trump is no different than their dictators. They're relieved that he's no different than their corrupt leaders. Mm-hmm. Their leaders in some of these countries who profit off of the presidency, Trump does too. They put their family members in the government, Trump does too. In a way, what Donald Trump has done is he's reduced us to the level of every other country. Mm-hmm. People say, see, you're just like us. You're not exceptional. You're just like us. You can get a Mobutu too.
You mentioned a moment ago Nelson Mandela. Fairly recently, you traveled to Africa for the first time in your life, I believe, and you say there are some lessons for America and what happened in post-apartheid South Africa. What can we learn from that?
I think we're going to learn a lot. The country that's probably the most like us is South Africa. It's an upside-down America. Demographically, it's upside down, right? White Americans are 9% here. They're still over 70, 60-something percent. But they were founded the same time-ish, about the same time, in the 1600s. They both had navigators arrive, and then soon slavery ensued. In South Africa, they enslaved the Khoikhoi and other tribes that they found right there, the Zulu and others, enslaved them in their own land rather than importing them. And they did import slaves from Malaysia. The Malaysian people in South Africa are the descendants of enslaved people. So they have a slavery narrative. They have a colonialism narrative. They had a connection to Britain like we did. They broke away from Britain in the 1940s. And then apartheid started right thereafter. The people, the Afrikaners, decided to create a society in which only white people had rights, which Americans did too. After the Civil War, white Americans created a society in which only they had rights to keep the former enslaved out of power. So we have very parallel histories. During the 1950s and 60s, particularly once Dr. Martin Luther King was really fighting for civil rights here, he was even commenting on things like the massacres in Soweto. He was noticing what was happening there, and they were commenting on each other. South Africans were really paying attention to the civil rights fights that Reverend Sharpton was waging in New York, and he was down there with me, and I've never seen anything like it. He's just revered in South Africa because they saw him as a black man standing up, and look, you're doing that in New York. That's what we want here. And so they love the guy. I mean, people were calling him Papa and hugging him and crying. I've never heard that before.
I never realized that he registered all that 100%. Far away.
They were watching him on TV.
Wow.
Right? And so they were seeing while they were having their phase. Remember, apartheid went all the way to 1990.
Yeah.
So in the 80s, when African Americans here were technically, you know, we had full civil rights, they still were living under apartheid and watching Reverend Al. So they really loved him. So we can learn a lot from South Africa because we're so much like them.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they did after apartheid ended, first of all, a lot of the really recalcitrant segregationists just left. There was a huge white flight out of South Africa, mostly to places like Australia and New Zealand, which formed the basis of some of their far-right white nationalist parties today. Those who stayed behind do a lot of what Americans do. White South Africans, I spoke to a professor down there in Cape Town who said it's a no-no to even talk about being racist down here. No one wants to be the worst thing to be labeled as racist, similar to here.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. White South Africans, just like white Americans, it's the worst thing you could accuse them of, right? Mm-hmm. They don't want anything to do with it. There's a lost memory of apartheid in which no one was part of it, right? Oh, that was my racist neighbor. It wasn't my father.
Yeah.
It was the other guy, right?
Yeah.
They sort of reject the idea that, and they reject in that sense their own complicity in it and how they benefited from it. They still have the best homes, the most money, the most of everything, but they just, you know, they own 80% of the land. But there's a rejection of really dealing with it. The Truth and Reconciliation Commissions were very much grounded in Christianity. Desmond Bishop Tutu was really a leader of it. But it worked, according to this professor. It worked mainly because Nelson Mandela was not a peacenik going in. He was a warrior going in. Mm-hmm. He actually created the armed wing of the ANC. That's why he was in prison. The Umkhonto Sizwe was the armed wing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. People forget about that. Yeah.
He was the fighter. He was the guy who was fighting them, you know, in a warlike manner.
Yeah.
He was a tribal chief. He's the son of a tribal chief. So this guy wasn't there to play around with South Africa. He was there to fight South Africa.
Right.
So when he came out, he was the only man in a position really to negotiate peace.
Mm-hmm.
And to his internal credit, he decided to do that. He decided to forgive and reconcile. But the challenge that they've had is that truth and reconciliation was mainly for Black people, to convince Black people through this Christian intonation to forgive white people.
Yeah.
It wasn't to redress any of the grievances economically, mm-hmm. et cetera. We have the same challenge now.
Yeah. The question is, then, who is the Mandela to elevate us above our own grievances and resentments?
It's funny because the South Africans that I interviewed for the book really felt that Barack Obama was tried,
mm-hmm.
that he was the person who most attempted to do
sure.
it. But what they saw looking from South Africa on is when he tried, he was rejected so outright and so viciously by the Mitch McConnells of the world, the Paul Ryans, they literally got together on the night of the inauguration, Ryan and McCarthy and Mitch McConnell, and plotted what in the 60s would have been called massive resistance to his presidency, you know, really not accepting him as president and not even allowing him to appoint a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah.
That's never happened. So it's not clear. You know, South Africa in a lot of ways is more advanced than we are on race because they're much more blunt about it because Black people are the majority. So they have to deal with it. We, I think, are behind them in a sense of trying to do even truth and reconciliation. We haven't done it. But one thing I definitely learned from being down there is that the only way to overcome a noxious history is to confront it. You really do need to confront it. And Americans don't want to do that because we have a heroic narrative about ourselves. But if we don't do it, we're not going to get very far.
Yeah, and I think I'm not alone in that it's very hard to figure out what the trajectory of the country is right now, because here we are, we elected the first Black president twice. Everyone was saying that we were in this post-racial society, and then suddenly we follow it up with Donald Trump. So what do you think that means? Which one was the fluke? Was it the election of Barack Obama, or was it the election of Donald Trump?
I think neither. You know, the history of the United States is that, you know, we fought a civil war to end slavery. 600,000 people died because one side literally refused to give up their slaves, refused to give up this dehumanizing system, and were willing to die to keep it. And then we had this sort of attempt at reconstruction that in a lot of ways was really groundbreaking and historic, which was ended in the 1870s, in 1877, the minute Northern troops pulled out of the South, the redemption period swept in which at the time Southern Democrats put down any attempts at Black Southerners to have equality or to live normal lives with lynching, murder, terror, torture, lynching children, women. I mean, the violence in the 1870s through like the 1930s, 4,000 lynchings, just vicious terrorism, blowing up churches, blowing up buses, killing Northern and Southern, white and Black, hanging Italians who were considered mongrels, hanging Jewish people. I mean, we don't confront how terrifying the post-Civil War, post-Reconstruction period was, but it was awful.
Yeah.
Then it was compounded by the Depression, which put everyone at odds. Everyone was having sort of a race to the bottom for what little spoils were left of the economy. So we've had a lot of bad history. This isn't the first bad history. It's not even the first president whose racial views were shocking. You know, again, Woodrow Wilson, Andrew Jackson. You know, there are tapes of Nixon. It's not that that's so new. Trump isn't.
But a lot of those we learned after the fact.
That's the difference.
This is the first time where he's
in real time
overtly racist and just puts it right out there.
Well, the other thing is, and Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a great piece called The First White President, in which he makes the point that I think I made a bit earlier, which is that all of those presidents, and again, it's the reason that I called it the American story, is that even those previous presidents, Andrew Jackson, when he ran for president, and this is the guy who did the Trail of Tears, he didn't run on Indian removal.
Mm-hmm.
He ran on the heroic narrative of his role in the War of 1812.
Right.
He ran on heroism.
Yeah.
Right? Woodrow Wilson didn't run on the idea that he was going to screen Birth of a Nation and that Black people wouldn't be allowed to be in his administration. He didn't run on that at all. He ran on making the world safe for democracy. FDR barely included Black people in the New Deal, but Black people flocked to him because his presentation of what the world should be like was the Four Freedoms. Yeah. And everyone can agree with the four freedoms. You know, Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner, but the narrative that he was putting forward about what America was about personal liberty and freedom. And even his slaves believed in it, so much so that the second the Civil War was over, formerly enslaved Black people started running for office because they believed in the narrative. Even if the narrative wasn't helping them at the time, enslaved people still believed in it. And so the problem with Trump is he's breaking our faith in the narrative. And one of the people I interviewed for the book that talked about the fact that we need a new songbook for America in order to be one country, because we're really actually kind of two countries, but in order to force us together, you either need a war, which that's not going to work now because people won't necessarily believe Donald Trump if he says we need to go to war.
Yeah.
You need an external enemy, which we had with the Cold War, which brings everybody together, or you need a narrative. And I don't know what the narrative is now when Donald Trump's narrative is only about Donald Trump.
Well, before we go, I have to ask, do you think that 2020 will be as crazy or maybe even crazier than 2016? I mean,
crazier. Now
we have proof of concept that a foreign government can interfere in a U.S. election. We have proof of concept that a candidate can say horribly offensive things and still get elected.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, the gloves are off and anything goes this time. What do you think?
I think that's right. And, you know, one of the things that scares a lot of Democrats is that Speaker Nancy Pelosi is counting on the election to cleanse the office of Donald Trump, and that the Congress doesn't have to act because an election will wash him out. But that's presuming it's a free and fair election. As you've said, Russia knows they succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. I interviewed Naveed Jamali for the book, who says that Americans don't really can't grasp how much Vladimir Putin hates America and feels that we are responsible for destroying the great Soviet Union. He wants revenge. He's not doing this because he likes Donald Trump. He's doing it because he hates us. And now that he's succeeded, why wouldn't he do it again? Why wouldn't he keep the chaos going? Not because he likes Trump, because he likes the chaos. He likes us not being leader of the free world. But now look at the G20 summit. Look at who Donald Trump got photo ops with. Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. He's attracted to Rodrigo Duterte of the Philippines. He's attracted to Erdogan in Turkey. Xi Jinping, who's just declared himself president for life of China. Yeah. He's attracted to autocrats. Why wouldn't any of them interfere in the election? Why wouldn't all of them do it? And so now that we have, in addition to that, an attorney general, William Barr, who has essentially said Donald Trump can do whatever he wants. I have his back. Who's going to stop him?
Boy.
And so I think Democrats and, you know, people in Congress and independents who are concerned about Trump and are assuming the election will fix it. I don't think 2016 was the half of it. I think 2020 will be 2016 on steroids.
Oof. Gird your loins, America. Once more, the book is called The Man Who Sold America, Trump and the Unraveling of the American Story. Joanne Reed, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Joanne Reed for coming on the show. Order her new book, The Man Who Sold America, Trump and the Unraveling of the American Story, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Watch her show AM Joy Saturdays and Sundays at 10 a.m. Eastern on MSNBC, and follow her on Twitter at Joanne Reed. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already, and if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.